dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight on the program, cannibalizing America to boost the corporate bottom line. How corporations are paying scholars to undermine the power of juries. A call to action against oligarchy from Scott Ritter. The death of Horatio Alger. And another reading from Disciplined Minds on how idealistic young people are broken to the yoke of corporate service.
Never a hard-working man I oppress. So take your pace easy. Go home soon like lightning. We soon will.
On December 3rd, the Los Angeles Times published an article by Alan Zarembo. The title of the article: Funding Studies to Suit Need. In the 1990s, Exxon began paying for research into juries and the damages they award. The findings have served the firm well in court. Zarembo wrote, "In 1994, it was the biggest punitive damages judgment in history. $5.3 billion that an Alaskan federal jury awarded to fishermen and others whose livelihood had been devastated by the Exxon Valdez oil tanker spill. 3 years later, as Exxon waged its appeal, a new line of research began to appear in several respected academic journals and Ivy League law reviews. Some articles challenged the competence of juries to fairly set punitive damages. Others suggested that such awards are ultimately bad for society. Exxon cited several of the articles in the appeal. What it did not say in court filings is that it had funded the research. Companies frequently contract with professors to testify as expert witnesses in court. But Exxon went a step further. It hired at least 9 esteemed psychologists, economists, and law and business school faculty members, giving them research funding that most social scientists can only dream about. Now, the 13 papers they published, several of them rewritten and reissued in a book that came out last year, are popping up in legal arguments in other punitive damages cases cited both by companies defending themselves and by judges issuing opinions. And they are ruffling the feathers of competing professors who dispute their conclusions and complain about the difficulty of raising money for independent research. The social sciences have long been seen as low-stakes disciplines, free from the funding controversies that have roiled the harder sciences. But with public money for social science research waning, universities have not stood between professors and the corporations willing to fund their work. Such arrangements have raised critical debates over whether academic researchers are becoming hired guns for industry. It is very troublesome that work published as scholarship is being vetted by lawyers for Exxon," said Richard Lempert, a law professor at the University of Michigan and a leading critic of the Exxon-sponsored studies. "It was designed to serve Exxon. It was not done because they wanted to know how juries behaved." Tom Siriglano, a spokesman from ExxonMobil Corporation, said a better understanding of punitive damages not only helps his employer, which he described as, quote, the target of a number of suits that are just a matter of a trial attorney going after a company with deep pockets, close quote, but also benefits, quote, everyone else in this country. He said the company had not exerted any control over the conclusions of the studies. But the research that was ultimately published served Exxon's interests. Punitive damages have been big news since the early 1990s. Some cases that attracted attention seemed to spoof the U.S. legal system. Among them, the $2 million that a court ordered McDonald's to pay a customer who had spilled hot coffee on herself. The award was ultimately reduced. Others, such as massive damage awards against tobacco companies, affect many more people. Earlier this month, an Alabama jury ruled that ExxonMobil had cheated the state out of natural gas royalties and handed down a verdict that included $11 billion in punitive damages, a judgment the company has vowed to appeal. Although most punitive damage cases are mundane, typically companies suing companies, industry leaders live in fear of large awards and often campaign against them. The Exxon research has provided them with ammunition. The first use of the research in court came in the Exxon Valdez case itself. The accident dumped 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound on March 24, 1989, and devastated the local fishing industry. In its appeal of the $5.3 billion verdict to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, Exxon, as well as industry groups, cited several of the Exxon-sponsored papers, with no mention that it had funded the work. The company argued that, quote, these articles present recent social science research demonstrating that jurors are generally incapable of performing the tasks the law assigns them in punitive damage cases, close quote. Plaintiff's attorney submitted a counterbrief dismissing the studies as junk social science. Arguments ensued, stretching the appeal on and on. In 2001, the Ninth Circuit Court ruled in Exxon's favor. The justices returned the case to the judge in Alaska Federal Court with an order for reduction of the penalty. The judge complied, lowering the award to $4 billion. A figure that the company has continued to challenge in court. The case remains unsolved, though the Exxon-funded research apparently is having an effect, at least indirectly. In a separate U.S. Supreme Court case involving State Farm Insurance, leading corporations filed a brief that repeatedly cited Exxon-funded research. The plaintiffs, backed by 21 academics, countered with a lengthy attack on the studies. In April, the High Court, which has generally opposed large punitive damage awards, overturned a $145 million judgment against State Farm. In light of that ruling, the Ninth Circuit justices in February again returned the Exxon case to the lower court to consider whether the $4 billion award still held up legally. Thus, Exxon-funded studies had been used in a separate case that was now coming back to help Exxon. Judges have also used the research in their opinions. A search of legal databases turned up 10 cases since 1999 in which judges have invoked studies funded by Exxon. Random and freakish punitive awards have no place in federal court. And intellectual discipline should be maintained, a judge in Illinois wrote, citing one of the articles in 2002. In New York in 2003, a judge cited two of the articles in ordering a new trial in a case in which Island Def Jam Music Group had been ordered to pay $132 million in punitive damages to TVT Records. The Exxon-funded research has become the backbone of Punitive Damages, How Juries Decide, published last year by the University of Chicago Press. The authors conclude the juries are erratic and unpredictable in awarding punitive damages, calling the Exxon-funded book a path-breaking multidisciplinary study. Another judge invoked it in a discussion of a class action suit against cigarette makers, but ultimately decided to let the case proceed. Individual articles don't make a difference, said Theodore Eisenberg, a Cornell law professor who has written extensively about the Exxon-funded work. But when the same story is repeated over and over, judges are part of society. Whatever shapes your beliefs will shape theirs. The biggest public grants for mock jury studies, in which juries composed of paid research subjects are presented with cases and observed while they make decisions, came from the National Science Foundation and top out at $250,000, enough for a 3,000-person experiment. The jury studies that Exxon funded used more than 8,000 subjects. ExxonMobil said in a written statement that the cost of its studies was a confidential matter, but academics estimate the total bill at more than $1 million. Such investments have some scholars worried that industry will set the research agenda. Edith Green, a psychology professor at the University of Colorado and co-author of the book Determining Damages, The Psychology of Jury Awards, published this year, suggested that some of the money Exxon had paid would have been better spent on other questions. What sorts of technology could help jurors in determining punitive damage awards? How do judges influence decision-making? No corporate bottom line is hanging out there waiting for the answers to those questions, she said. The Exxon-funded professors insisted that they had retained intellectual control, although they acknowledged that company officials had commented on drafts, charted progress, and coordinated meetings. All the papers acknowledge Exxon funding. I want to be very clear here, said John Payne, a business school professor at Duke University. We were the ones who decided what the design would be, what the questions would be, how it would be written up for the journals, close quote. He and others noted that some of the published works had fallen short of Exxon's hopes. For example, he said the company probably would have liked to demonstrate bias against out-of-town defendants, but the data did not support that. Cass Sunstein at first refused to join the project when a group of Exxon officials visited the University of Chicago, where he is a law professor. But he changed his mind after a fellow researcher, Daniel Kahneman, a Princeton psychology professor who went on to win a Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002, persuaded him that they could remain independent. Still, Sunstein refused to accept money other than travel expenses. I felt it was very important just for me personally to feel that the research was not affected by money. Even though Exxon imposed no restrictions or strings, direct or indirect, he said. The others refused to say how much they had earned. That's personal, said David Schade, a business professor at the University of Texas at Austin. I don't keep tabs on that, said Kip Viscusi, a Harvard law professor, suggesting that some of the criticism stemmed from professional jealousy. We can say we had complete freedom and nobody believes us. His work also used funding from Harvard Olin Center for Law, Economics, and Business. Another researcher, Reed Hasty, a University of Chicago psychology professor, combined Exxon funding with a $113,100 grant from the National Sciences Foundation. About half of the work originally appeared in peer-reviewed journals. meaning that articles were sent out with the authors' names blacked out to anonymous reviewers who advised editors on whether the work should be published. Rich Wiener, editor of Law and Human Behavior, where three Exxon-funded articles were published, said those papers had undergone exactly the same review process as all others. Reviewers who were informed of Exxon's involvement approved the papers, based on the quality of the research and the methodology independent of any funding source, he said. The articles are the only ones in his 7 years as an editor that were funded by a corporation, he said. In at least one case, Exxon cut off funding for research that didn't match its interests. In the summer of 1996, William Freudenberg, then a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, received an offer from Exxon. In return for $240 an hour, Freudenberg agreed to write an article about whether punitive awards actually deterred bad behavior and thus reduced risks to society. He signed a contract giving the company the rights to his work for 1 year. According to Freudenberg, a company official told him that Exxon was specifically looking for articles that could be used in court to argue that punitive awards don't make much sense. Freudenberg presented a paper in August at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association about his experience. Although he did not name Exxon or its representative in the article, he confirmed their identities in an interview with The Times. Last month, the Exxon contact he identified, Terry Gardner, told The Times, "I am not authorized to speak about this project." Gardner proved a valuable and friendly resource, suggesting articles to read and sending books he deemed useful, said Freudenberg, who kept Gardner abreast of his progress. In late 1996, he sent Exxon a 19-page draft of a paper that he planned to submit to the journal Risk Analysis. It was not welcomed enthusiastically, Freudenberg said. The draft argued in part that fears of punitive damage awards do not improve public safety, an argument that suited Exxon's appeal. But the thrust of the paper was that more openness in corporations is an important way to reduce the likelihood of environmental disasters. That was a position Exxon did not want to support, Freudenberg said. The contract, which had netted Freudenberg, quote, maybe $10,000, was terminated. In its written statement, ExxonMobil did not dispute Freudenberg's version of events. But the statement said, quote, "While ExxonMobil has no interest in his paper, we at no time discouraged him from publishing it himself," close quote. Now a professor at UC Santa Barbara, Freudenberg has yet to do so. As for his experience with Exxon, he is philosophical. "They treated me very well, but that doesn't make it any better for society." And that was an article, "Funding Studies to Suit Need" by Alan Zarembo, published in the December 3rd edition of the Los Angeles Times. And you're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
You got a penthouse in the city and another home in the hills. You got a corner office on the 51st floor and you walk on a carpet made of $100 bills. Well, I look at you up there in your plush office chair and I wonder what is going through your brain. As you look outside your window, watch the people moving by below. You must be thinking about your capital gains. Now you look me in the eye and tell me exactly what it is you do. Correct me if I'm wrong, but but it seems to me that you make your money from the grueling work that other people do while they're slaving away in fields and factories. You're sipping your coffee on Madison Avenue. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul? 'Cause the life you are making for us is spinning out of control. You tell me this is fair. You tell me that they'll get their share. You say that you worked hard to get there, but I'm asking if you see from that tinted window in the air how many people must be poor so you can be a billionaire. You say this is the way it has to be competitive in the economy. Poverty is a market incentive to keep people from being lazy. And I say to you, if you believe that shit they taught you in school, you must be crazy. Sometimes it makes me angry. Sometimes I like to cry. How many people been working all their lives for nothing? They'll be working until they die. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul? 'Cause the life you were making for us is spinning out of control. Sometimes blame is just like honey, gets all over everything, and it's never enough to be careful what you buy when you're shopping. In a land known for democracy, it's amazing how it comes to be. Freedom is the choice between Coke and Pepsi. So don't tell us your free markets will satisfy our needs. Don't tell us that what's good for Monsanto is good for me. You rob us of our livelihoods and our grandmother's seeds. Your endless thirst for profit is a social disease. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Or did you just come from the right?
Scott Ritter is a former U.S. Marine officer and United Nations weapons inspector who has become an outspoken critic of the invasion of Iraq and the Bush administration's policies. Lately, he's been in the news again as a result of revelations that in the late 90s, UNSCOM, the United Nations weapon inspection team of which he was a part, was asked for and provided information to British intelligence for the purpose of crafting a propaganda campaign to create public support in the UK for an invasion of Iraq. The speech by Ritter we're about to hear was given on December 13th in Los Angeles and sponsored by the People of Color Against Globalization. A member of the group, educator and community broadcaster Bill Gallegos, introduces Ritter.
People of Color Against Globalization is a network of activists who are working to build an anti-corporate globalization movement in communities of color. And we think that's important because on a world scale, it's primarily the people of color throughout the world, the people of the global south, who are spearheading the fight against corporate globalization. And corporate globalization has a consequence for all of us in the environment, in the economy, in politics, in this military sphere. It has consequences for everything. And in our communities, in oppressed communities of color, we've been experiencing a globalization for 500 years. This is nothing new to us. The idea of privatization began with stealing the communal lands of the native peoples. That was the first incidence of privatization that happened in North America, where European settlers began to take what had been common lands, the communal lands of the native indigenous peoples, and to take those over and turn them into private holdings. So this idea of privatizing what has been common property is not something that's really unique and not something that's new. It has a new form, it has a new a power behind it, but it's clearly something that in our communities we've experienced from day one. Military conquest, you know, the military conquest of the native peoples, the annexation of Mexico, the forcible enslavement of Africans, the fact that Chinese coolie labor was brought over after the slave trade was outlawed. They used the slave ships to bring over Chinese coolie labor to form a kind of neo-slave labor in building the railroads here in this country. So there's a real precedent in our community of experiencing globalization, but also of resistance to globalization. A very powerful, I think, creative and profound kind of resistance that has a really essential democratic and very kernel of social justice, which I think has been there from the beginning of our struggles. So what we want to do now is to challenge the current manifestations of corporate globalization by building a movement in our communities that's connected with the kinds of struggles that we're fighting every day for jobs, for immigrants' rights, for union rights, for educational justice, for health justice, for an end to police brutality and INS harassment and racism against our communities. So we're trying to connect with the very day-to-day fights of our people for human dignity, for social justice, for human rights. We're trying to connect that with this larger worldwide movement for a sense of global justice. And that's what we're trying to do. That's our endeavor. I think it's a very important project, and it's something new. It really is an experiment, and people from different communities are coming together and trying to build a kind of unified perspective that also recognizes the very particular diversity of our communities. And we're also very glad to reach out our hands to the non-communities of color, to the Anglo-European communities, to the peace communities, to the non-intervention communities, to the environmental communities, and say, join us in this common effort to achieve a world of global justice. So that's part of what we want to do this program tonight, so we can look at two kind of elements of corporate globalization and begin to have a better understanding of that, and with that understanding, we can begin to do something about it. So, I really appreciate your being here, and I really appreciate your support for this endeavor. And now I'd like to introduce Scott Ritter. As we know, this is another person who was willing to take a courageous stand and to tell the truth, really. These days, speaking the truth takes a lot of courage. And what he did was he reported on what he saw, what he found, what he was able to assess, when he was working for the United Nations as a weapons inspector in Iraq. And he, for that, for putting forward this truth, prior to the invasion of Iraq, he was vilified, he was attacked by the government, by the media. And you would think that now that what he said has been verified post-invasion, no weapons of mass destruction, no biological weapons, no chemical weapons, no nuclear weapons, no capability of destroying our country within 45 minutes, as Tony Blair was saying, you would think that he would be all over the media, that he would be the star of Fox Television, the star of MSNBC, the star of Ted Koppel. But yet we still see this kind of effort to kind of exclude the truth from the people of this country. So it's really a privilege for us, for him to be here tonight to share with us his perspectives And he's going to be here to talk a little bit about his new book, which is here called Frontier Justice, and he's going to be signing the book afterwards. So I really encourage everyone to buy the thing, to read it, and to get it out to other people. Let's give it up for Scott Ritter.
If I had my preference, there wouldn't be a war in Iraq, and there wouldn't be a reason for me to standing before you here tonight. But unfortunately, the situation is what the situation is. We find ourselves 9 months into an occupation of a sovereign country that, while ruled by a brutal dictator, posed no threat to the United States of America worthy of military intervention. I probably don't need to highlight this, but I will just to show you what's transpiring here tonight, in case you haven't quite caught on to it. How many registered Republicans are sitting here in the church tonight? Well, you got one standing here before you. How many people here voted for George W. Bush for the President of the United States? Well, you got one here standing before you. How many 12-year veterans of the United States Marine Corps who fought in Desert Storm do you have here today? Well, you got one standing here before you. And the point I'm trying to make here is that we come from different backgrounds. We probably come from different political ideologies. But we're united in one thing. And we are citizens of the United States of America. And we do believe in something that is good and just. We believe in the concepts of liberty and justice for all. We believe in peace and justice. We believe in the values and ideals that define this country. And we are concerned that the country we live in has deviated significantly from those values and ideals. We, the people of the United States of America, we are the government. We are that which defines this nation. And we collectively have a problem. And that problem, I think, manifests itself in Iraq. You know, this has not been a nation that has been built on perfection. Not at any time in our nation's history can you say that we were perfect. We were formed in a flawed fashion, a nation that espoused liberty and justice for all but still endorsed slavery, a nation that didn't give women the right to vote till a century later, a nation that still struggles to come to grips with concepts of human rights, civil liberties, here at home, in our own country, let alone the concept of exporting American democracy abroad. We haven't cobbled together the perfect vision of democracy here at home, and yet, we stand for something good in this country, and we have great potential. I've always been one who believes that the duties and responsibilities of a citizen is to take a critical look at the country that you live in and identify problems when you see them and then undertake that which is necessary to rectify these problems. I was one of these people that naively believed that we had a solid foundation upon which we were building something good, and that when we're talking about fixing this country, we're talking about cosmetic fixtures, maybe fixing a broken window here, maybe fixing a door that's a little ajar there, doing a little sanding here, a little painting there. But ladies and gentlemen, when we reflect on Iraq and what's happening in Iraq today, I'm here to tell you right now, the foundation of this country is flawed. And we will never, ever build anything worthy of the promise of the United States until we fix this foundation. The United States of America today is a nation that is ill. It is a diseased country. We are sick. And we can't talk about fixing things by addressing the symptoms. We have to address the disease. And ladies and gentlemen, the disease is us. We are the problem. And Iraq is a manifestation of this problem. When we think about why we're in Iraq, We were told by the President of the United States that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that not only violated international law, but posed a grave and imminent threat to the security of the United States and indeed the security of the entire world. Now, the President said this not in a speculative fashion. He said it using words such as, "I know these weapons to exist." Now, I may be a simple Marine, but when someone says that they know something, that implies certainty of knowledge. That means that there is a baseline of factual data that the President is relying on. And here we are 9 months into the occupation, and how many weapons of mass destruction have been uncovered in Iraq? None. And I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that they will not uncover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That the entire basis for this war was a fraud. The President lied to us. And yet, this was not a lie that should only manifest itself 9 months into an occupation. It was a lie that was as plain as the nose on your face. The President never provided any factual data to sustain his allegations that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. You will not find a single United Nations report that says Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction or has reconstituted a production base to produce weapons of mass destruction. What you'll hear from the United Nations is that they cannot verify with absolute certainty Iraq's assertions that all weapons of mass destruction have been destroyed, that the United Nations cannot confirm this, that there are still gaps in the understanding about the totality of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, and therefore the United Nations is unable to close the book on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. You know, I endorse that. I endorse that. Iraq was a nation that had possessed massive quantities of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is a nation that, when called upon by the international community to disarm, chose not to. Lied, concealed, dissimulated, obstructed the work of the inspectors. Therefore, when Iraq suddenly comes up and declares disarmament by dictate, "Yes, we lied to you, but we now have no weapons of mass destruction," they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt. Their words must be backed up with verifiable, substantive fact, and until which time that is done, it would be irresponsible to declare Iraq free of weapons of mass destruction. But there's a big difference between saying we cannot confirm that Iraq has destroyed all of its weapons of mass destruction and saying that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction that constitute a threat. The President said that he knew Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction, and yet he provided no data to back this up. Congress of the United States, remember, we live in a democracy that's based upon three separate but equal branches of government. The President and his administration constitute the executive branch. But then there are the people's representatives, the congressmen and women, the senators whom we elect to represent us, who are responsible for providing appropriate checks and balances to the President of the United States so that executive power does not become dictatorial power in this democratic republic we call the United States of America. And what did Congress do? How many of our brave representatives raised their hand and said, "Excuse me, Mr. President, could you back up what you're saying with data?" Very few. Tragically, you can count them on your hands. One of them is Dennis Kucinich, a brave man, a man who from the very beginning questioned this war. How many people listened to Dennis Kucinich? None. How many people are listening to Dennis Kucinich today? Not too many. How many people should be listening to Dennis Kucinich? Every single American out there. But it's not happening. What did Congress do? Did they stand up for the rights of the American people? Did they inadequately represent us? No. Congress abrogated their constitutional responsibilities when it comes to war. The founders, the framers of this nation, the United States of America, clearly set forth in the Constitution that defines us as a people, as a nation, that the power to declare war is that of the Congress of the United States, not the President of the United States. And the reason why they gave it to Congress is so that it would be a difficult decision to make, so that Congress would have to reflect on the price their constituencies would pay should we go to war. And what did Congress do? Did they stand up and ask the president hard questions and demand hard answers? No, they punted. Congress voted to transfer war powers authority to the president of the United States before the president of the United States publicly declared his intention to go to war. Imagine that. An absolute dereliction of duty. But if that's not bad enough, there's the media, the fourth estate, you know, the watchdog of American democracy, the brave reporters who are supposed to go out there and inform the public, hold Congress accountable, hold the president accountable by publishing the truth, discussing the truth. But what did the media do? Stood there and spoon-fed the president's lies and Congress's dereliction of duty to the American people. Where was the media asking the tough questions? I'll give you a little anecdote. You know, in September of 2002, I went to Baghdad. Ann Coulter, brave defender of American freedom that she is, has belittled this trip, saying that it was un-American for me to go to Baghdad. Yeah, it was pretty un-American of me to go to Baghdad, I guess. It's un-American to go to Iraq and demand of the Iraqi government full and total compliance with Security Council resolutions, telling the Iraqi government that they had no choice but to give in to the Security Council's resolutions, the Security Council's demand for the return of weapons inspectors, that Iraq had no right to put forward preconditions for the return of inspectors, that if Iraq didn't allow the inspectors back in, Iraq would face total annihilation. It was un-American of me to tell the Iraqis that truth is on their side. They should not be afraid of the truth. If they have no weapons of mass destruction, then let the inspectors back in and truth will out. How naive I was. How utterly un-American I was to believe that truth will out. And that's what I did in Baghdad. I basically tried to open the door for a venue to resolve the situation between Iraq and the international community that would not lead to renewed military conflict. How un-American of me. I spoke to the Iraqi National Assembly on September 8th. On September 13th, Saddam Hussein agreed to allow inspectors back in, thereby opening the door for the possibility of resolving this situation peacefully. I came back to the United States and got a kind invitation from CNN to go to their headquarters and meet with their executives and their senior talking heads, basically 60 people in a crammed office space. They wanted to find out if I was some sort of wacko that was off his rocker and therefore not worthy of appearing on CNN's screens, or if there was some credibility or some legitimacy. So for an hour and 45 minutes, I was grilled by CNN on the position I took on Iraq. How dare I say that they have no nuclear weapons program? How do I respond to the vice president's assertions that Iraq is acquiring uranium? How do I respond to this centrifuge program, these aluminum tubes that I had the gall to say belong to artillery rockets? It's not as though I only spent 7 years in Iraq inspecting these 81-millimeter artillery tubes, knowing for absolute certainty that they were related artillery rockets, that they have nothing to do with the centrifuge program that I also investigated. No, I shouldn't dare speak the truth to the American people, especially on CNN's airwaves, lest they be embarrassed. Lest you have Paul Azan accuse me of drinking from Saddam's Kool-Aid. For an hour and 45 minutes, they asked me questions, and I was able to back up everything I said with documents and with statements of fact. And at the end, the CEO of CNN stood up and said that while he didn't agree with everything I said from a political standpoint, factually he couldn't contest it, and then he turned like the Pope to his assembled media people and said, "I certify, Mr. Ritter, as a source worthy of use. Feel free to use him on your programming. And now that I've been blessed, he turned to me and said, do you have any questions of us? I said, just one. You held me up here for an hour and 45 minutes, and you asked me all sorts of questions that I found somewhat demeaning and insulting, but I answered your questions. I proved that what I said has merit. So my question to you is, why do you dare question a 7-year veteran of the weapons inspection process about weapons of mass destruction when the President of the United States opens his mouth and you publish it without question? You have a double standard. You demand that I back up what I say, but when the President says something, you don't ask a single question. When are you going to start asking the President questions? When are you going to start asking his administration questions? Why do you merely just parrot their words? To which they had no answer. None whatsoever. So let's blame the media, too, as part of this diseased nation. But, ladies and gentlemen, here comes the toughest pill to swallow. Because when you take a look at the Constitution of the United States and the preamble of the Constitution, it doesn't say the President of the United States all-powerful. It doesn't say the Congress of the United States all-knowing. It doesn't say that it is the responsibility of the media to inform the people. It says we, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union. Ladies and gentlemen, the biggest symptom of the disease that afflicts this nation is us. We, the people. We're the problem because we're this country. And when we look at Iraq, Iraq is a manifestation of what ails us as a people. We didn't ask the president to back up his words about weapons of mass destruction. Oh, yeah, we did a couple demonstrations in the street. Weren't we wonderful? 200,000 people in the streets of New York City, and what good did it do? Once the bullets started flying, the people stopped walking. When people hijack the American flag on their lapels when they sit on TV and claim that the only patriot is somebody who supports the troops, somebody like George W. Bush, who avoided war, ran away from combat when it was his turn to serve, and yet had the gall to stand before the American people and say, bring them on, when talking about the Iraqi resistance. A man who didn't have the courage to fly a fighter airplane over Vietnam, but certainly had the courage to let somebody land him on an aircraft carrier so he could strut around in full military regalia, declaring an end to a war that is still raging in Iraq. You know, you got people on the streets waving the American flag, saying they're patriotic. Waving a flag doesn't make you patriotic. I can train a monkey to wave a flag, and that doesn't make that monkey patriotic. A patriot's somebody who can read the Constitution of the United States of America and live the Constitution of the United States of America. And we haven't done that collectively. Might have a few good citizens out there that have, but collectively we have failed to act in accordance with the responsibilities that the founding fathers of this nation transferred to us. We're responsible for what goes on here. We didn't ask the president questions. We're not holding Congress accountable, and we aren't doing anything to hold the media accountable for what they've done, and we're damn sure not holding ourselves accountable for our failure, our collective failure that is Iraq today. We're in Iraq. Is it about weapons of mass destruction? No, ladies and gentlemen, it's not. Is it about oil? It's not that simple. What it's about is American arrogance. The concept that the United States of America has some sort of God-given right to dictate to the entire world how it should live in a manner which best benefits we, the people of the United States. It's about American imperialism. It's about global hegemony. The war in Iraq is the first step of a larger process of transforming the Middle East into something that's more digestible by we, the people of the United States of America. You see, we're threatened by the concept of people who don't look like us, people who don't worship like us, people who don't talk like us. We're going to transform the Middle East, which means we're going to transform the Muslim world. Ladies and gentlemen, think of the arrogance of that statement. Think of the criminality of that statement. And think of your silence when Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld sit before the United States Senate and say just those same words. Why are we in Iraq? Because Iraq is the first phase of a larger struggle to transform the Middle East into an area that's more suitable for American-style democracy. You show me where in international law this is something that's permitted. I'll show you in international law where it's not permitted. I'll show you a little document called the United Nations Charter, of which we're a signatory. And then I'll refer you back to the Constitution of the United States of America. You see, Article 6 of the Constitution is very clear. When we, the people of the United States of America, and our elected representatives sign a treaty or enter into an international agreement that has been ratified by two-thirds of the United States Senate, it is the law of the land. We have signed the United Nations Charter. It has been ratified. It is a binding legal agreement. And yet we have a president, when confronted by a reporter just the other day about the potential illegalities of some of our economic dealings vis-a-vis Iraq, said, international law? I guess I better consult a lawyer on this one. No one ever told me about this. And he thought it was funny. When a president mocks international law, the president is mocking the Constitution, and therefore the president is mocking us, we, the people. What are we doing about it? What are we doing about it? Iraq is a manifestation of centuries of failure by the people of the United States to uphold the vision and promise of this great nation. We the people have stopped being citizens. We the people have instead become consumers who have wrapped ourselves in a cocoon of comfort. And so long as the powers that be keep us waddling down a relative path of prosperity, we are hesitant to rock the boat lest the prosperity end. But we've forgotten that it's our responsibility to rock the boat. That we're the ones that have to hold people accountable for what they do in our name. And when we fail to do so, we cease to function as a democratic republic. Four words, ladies and gentlemen, democratic republic. That's what we're supposed to be. Oligarchy, fascism. One is where we are today, the other is the direction we're heading. Oligarchy, concentration of power in the hands of a few. That's where we are today. We're not a democratic republic. We have ceded our responsibilities. We have ceded our authority. We have ceded our power to a power elite who govern in accordance with our addiction to a lifestyle that we cannot sustain except on the backs of others, non-Americans, people out there who have resources that we need at prices or that are convenient to us. And then this oligarchy takes it a step further, a confluence of corporate and national interests that uses war to promote national virility. The classic definition from Benito Mussolini of fascism. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't see a nation today under the leadership of President George W. Bush that defines a nation's virility through its military, then you must be blind. We have a president today that doesn't export democracy. He exports American military divisions. He's a president that shoots first and asks questions later. He's a president that likens himself as a cowboy, sort of a vision of the old West. You know, I got no problems with cowboys. They're sort of neat people. They get up early in the morning, they get on their horse, and they ride out there and they herd the cattle. They repair the fences. They're honorable people. They don't make that much money. And so things are valuable to them that can't be defined in terms of price, like friendship, honor, integrity. Cowboys are the kind of people that would ride 60 miles in a blizzard to deliver food to a neighbor that needed food. Cowboys are people that will stay up all night to help a colicky horse to make sure that horse recovers. Cowboys are good people. George W. Bush ain't no cowboy. He calls himself, likes himself to be like a sheriff. He's bringing justice to the world. You know? Because we got some bad people out there. We got evil doers. And we need to bring justice. We got a frontier out there. You know what a frontier is? Frontier is that area between civilization, i.e. America, and the wilderness, the rest of the world. And you got the frontier where the rule of law doesn't always apply because it can't, because you got bad guys running around. So you need frontier justice. You need a tough, steely-eyed marshal to come riding in there and bring the law down to civilize the wilderness. And that's George W. Bush, ladies and gentlemen. The steely-eyed marshal riding in on his white horse, bringing justice at the end of a pistol. It's a tough thing, bringing justice sometimes. You got bad guys like Black Bart, also known as Saddam Hussein, the cattle rustler, or the proliferator of weapons of mass destruction. And he's in jail. And he's been stealing cattle, i.e. proliferating weapons of mass destruction, for some time now. And we're waiting for the circuit judge to come in and try this guy, also known as the United Nations. That circuit judge, though, he's drunk. He's holed up in a whorehouse in New Orleans. He's not going to come around for a long time because he's useless. And we don't have time to wait for traditional justice. So George W. Bush kicked down the jail cell, dragged Black Bart out there, and strung him up by the neck until he was dead. And then while his feet are still twitching, desperately looks around for evidence of the cattle that he allegedly rustled and didn't find any. Frontier justice, ladies and gentlemen. Is that what we want? George W. Bush isn't even a sheriff, though. See, a sheriff's somebody that'll come up and stare you in the eyes, at least tell you right to your face, I accuse you of doing something, I'm going to take you on. Go for your gun. Bush doesn't have the courage to stare anybody in the face and say, go for your gun. Bush is a bushwhacker. A bushwhacker, ladies. You know what a bushwhacker is? It's the most cowardly form of combat you can imagine from the Old West. The bushwhacker is somebody who waits up behind a bush, behind a stone, lets somebody ride by, and then shoots him in the back without warning. Bushwhacker's a liar, a cheat, a thief. And that's what we got. A president who's willing to violate not only international law, but the Constitution of the United States, the very values and ideals that define who we are as a people, and doesn't even have the courage to tell it to us in our face. President Bush is symptomatic of the disease that besets this country. Iraq and the policies of the Bush administration in Iraq are symptomatic of the disease. But the real disease is the people who sustain this president, the people who sustain this policy. It's high time we stand up and say, no, we the people aren't going to take it anymore. When was the last time you held your congressman or woman accountable for his or her vote on the war on Iraq? How many people went up and said, wait a minute, why are you continuing to fund this war to the tune of $87 billion when we haven't found any weapons of mass destruction? I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but no offense to anybody here, look how many people are in this room. We're in the city of Los Angeles, the city of angels. And how many people really give a damn about what's happening in Iraq? Not too many. Why? Because they aren't citizens. They're consumers. So you want to move forward here, we got to talk about curing the disease, not just the symptoms. Yeah, you can go out in the streets and you can protest the war in Iraq. You're just addressing a symptom.